Welcome to the Foresight Health Roundup podcast, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Thursday, March 14th. Sunday is St. Patrick's Day. A few years ago, I took one of those Ancestry.com DNA tests. It turns out I'm 8% Irish, so I will be celebrating on Sunday. What people aren't celebrating Sunday or any other day of the week lately is private equity ownership in healthcare. On today's show, we're going to round up some of the latest healthcare PE news, and Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital, are going to tell us where all this activity is headed. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you two doing this morning? Dave?
Well, it's a dark and stormy morning here in Chicago. What gives with thunderstorms in March? Then again, it's going to be over 60 degrees here today. So when cold air meets hot air, thunder and lightning happen, just like when federal regulators meet avaricious corporate behavior. How's that for a segue into today's topic, Dave?
Yeah, that's a little foreshadowing there. Look forward to it. Julie, how are you?
I am well. I'm in hot, sunny Florida, but I just spent yesterday with the really incredible NCQA board, and we heard from David Kelly from Pennsylvania Medicaid, who talked about, just so inspiring, talking about outcomes related to data flowing, related to focusing on quality, related to, you know, efficiency and cost. Like, it all works together when it works. So I have renewed energy despite our topic today.
That's great. His head's in the right place. Excellent. That's good to hear. Now, before we talk about what's going on with private equity, let's talk about St. Patrick's Day. You know, they say everyone is Irish on St. Patrick's Day. Dave, do you have any Irish blood in you?
Well, I'm Irish by marriage, and I'm pretty good at math, so I think that makes me 100% Irish.
Yes, being married for 40 years, I agree 100% with you. Thanks, Dave. Julie, is any part of you Irish the whole year round or just this Sunday?
I definitely have some Irish somewhere in my Northern European mutt nature, and green is my favorite color, but, you know, it's more of a holiday for me. It's not a lifestyle.
Got it. Well, in addition to finding out that I'm 8% Irish, I'm also 14% Scottish and 22% English. And I thought I was 100% Polish. So oh. I could have vodka or whiskey. That was my silver lining.
That's exciting.
All I know, Dave, is you're 100% Chicago.
That is true. Thanks, Dave. That's a great compliment. Is there any silver lining in private equity ownership in healthcare? And there's your transition. Let me round up a few things that happened just in the past 2 weeks. The Federal Trade Commission, Justice Department, and HHS issued a public request for information on private equity acquisitions of healthcare providers like hospitals and medical practices. Public comments are due May 6th. A study published in Health Affairs said the number of PE-owned medical practice sites increased to nearly 6,000 in more than 300 metropolitan statistical areas in 2021, from about 800 in about 100 MSAs in 2012. Business Insider published a scathing expose on PE ownership of hospitals. The headline was, quote, "The Plundering of America's Hospitals," close quote. Ouch. An organization called the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, which describes itself as a nonprofit financial watchdog, launched a private equity hospital tracker. It also released a report that said 675 PE firms did 1,135 unique PE deals in healthcare in 2023. That's down slightly from 2021 and 2022. Dave, what's your take on these recent developments? Where are we headed with PE ownership in healthcare from a policy or reform perspective?
You know, Dave, it seems like we're discussing PE investments in healthcare at least every other week on Roundup here. But it's because PE is so ubiquitous in healthcare. On my walk to the Belmont L, I pass at least half a dozen new dental practices. Most of them have the word smile in them. And, you know, they're all part of PE roll-ups. Our discussions remind me of the Arab folktale about the frog and the scorpion. you know, where the scorpion convinces the frog to take him across the lake and then stings him halfway across. And as they're both going down, the frog goes, "What gives?" And the scorpion says, "It's in my nature." Well, it's in the nature of PE firms to make outsized profits. You know, when they buy companies, people seem to be surprised that they're handing them a knife and that it's sharp. You know, if PE companies had mission statements, it would be, you know, from that 87 movie Wall Street, Gordon Gekko's famous iconic speech, you know, greed is good. In 1947, Disney created Scrooge McDuck. Remember him, Dave?
Right. He was always sitting on a pile of money.
Right. And he described himself as an adventure capitalist. How hilarious is that? So like the poor, the tycoons like Scrooge McDuck will always be with us. The least we could do is tax their carried interest, but that's a story for another day. There are two issues when it comes to regulating PE investments in healthcare. And the regulators can do a lot about the first one and absolutely nothing about the second one. And the second one's probably more pernicious. Where they can be very effective and are trying to be more effective is stopping companies from getting monopoly pricing power in given markets. And as we've talked about, you know, numerous times, healthcare is replete with micro markets, regional markets, where payers, providers, suppliers exercise monopoly pricing power. The Fed should be all over that and be preventing it. So more power to them there. The second issue, as I, you know, hinted at, is beyond the regulator's power to control, and that's the artificial economic model upon which the U.S. healthcare system operates. The entire system depends on differential pricing for identical services. You know, I went back and reread Clay Christensen's The Innovator's Prescription, and he does a brilliant job of talking about the different waves of innovation and disruption that happen across all industries and then applying those theories to healthcare. And wave one is almost always centralization, right? You go from an analog world to an industrialized one, and it usually requires centralizing production capacity, which is expensive. You need expertise. And then there are various waves of innovation and disruption that come subsequently that enable manufacturers, suppliers to decentralize and get closer to customers, reduce pricing, and so on. And so, you know, wave one in healthcare is centralization. Think of hospitals, you know, high cost, high priced, lots of expertise. And then you've got these subsequent waves, you know, going from hospitals to ambulatory care centers. That reduces cost, creates efficiency, even further going into doctor's offices, doing procedures, even further going into the home, doing procedures. The trouble is that healthcare is stuck in wave one when it comes to pricing. We know how to do all these other disruptive things that should be driving down prices and improving customer service, but the hospitals still want to get paid hospital prices for doing all of these activities outside hospitals. So is it really a surprise when we have these kind of perverse pricing mechanism and perverse pricing incentives, economic incentives, that PE firms, when they take over control, try to exploit them to the max? It's what they do. Now, the dangerous thing is that as PE firms kind of push these perverse economics incentives and healthcare's artificial market to the max, they're creating fault lines within the overall ecosystem that are manifesting themselves with facility closures in low-income communities, urban and rural. And, you know, a lot of the coverage wants to blame PE for the fact that we have stupid healthcare pricing and stupid healthcare incentives. That's not PE's fault. And unfortunately, the regulators can't do anything about it. This is why, you know, on every version of our show, we talk about how do we fundamentally transform the model. How do we create value-based pricing and delivery of healthcare services? I mean, Julie was just talking about it from her inspiring session in Pennsylvania. We're never going to regulate our way to that outcome. I'm going to make two last points about PE. Not all PE firms are created equally. And many of them actually do focus on true value creation to earn their profits, and more power to them. Obviously, there are a bunch of others that choose to exploit perverse payment incentives, and we want them to go into the dustbins of history, but that probably is not going to happen anytime soon. And I guess the second point, and this gets lost in this discussion a lot, is, you know, PE firms make investments. They come in and they try to, you know, prop up companies, improve their performance, and then get out, you know, 5 to 7 years later. But in order to do that, they have to find buyers. And buyers, for the most part, aren't stupid. So they're going to pay a price that they think reflects the value of the entity they're purchasing. So PE firms doing it the right way create enough value to create an exit so that somebody buys a more valuable company than the PE firm acquired when it first did the investment. You know, if value comes from monopoly pricing power or exploiting perverse incentives, economic incentives, you know, kind of shame on all of us for letting that happen. And it does happen, but it doesn't have to be that way.
Right. It's not PE, it's what you do with it. That's a great analysis, Dave. Thank you. Julie, any questions for Dave?
Yeah, well, it is a little bit PE. And it is the market environment that we've created. So shame on us. So Dave, excellent analysis. And gosh, we should all go back and read Clay Christensen. Oh, so helpful.
Oh, I know. I know. What a loss that he's no longer with us. It's
What a loss. Yeah. Let's bring all that back, Britta. I agree with so much of what you said. And I read this scathing article about the MPT firm that's effectively like taken down Steward and a bunch of other systems because of their real estate deal that they did. So talk a little bit about like really even the more evil side of these stories.
And my last point from my opening remarks was that buyers aren't stupid. Well, no rule is 100% true. I thought the REIT money in hospitals or have thought the REIT money in hospitals is dumb money. When I was ending my banking career a little over 10 years ago, I went around to every health system in the country and said, you should sell your hospitals to the REITs. They're overpaying for the assets. And so you, health system, can actually reduce your financial risk by selling your hospitals and, you know, pocketing the money, investing it wisely and so on. Couldn't get any takers. The fact that MPT is losing their shirts on all of these hospitals that they've bought into. I mean, kind of classic dumb money move. So they're paying a price. And of course, the penalty manifests itself by hospitals closing in low-income areas. And that's not fair to the people who live in those communities, although I think we could question how many of those hospitals we actually need if we had a rational delivery system. But again, it's not the private equity's fault that MPT decided to step up and overpay for assets that haven't materialized.
All right, Julie. Anytime you have a tracker named after you, it's usually not good. What's your take on what's happening and where we're going from a market innovation perspective?
Well, I find myself in more and more of these conversations every day, and I hear healthcare veterans say all the old adages. Ah, the nuns say no margin, no mission. Or, you know, good health is good business. So it's funny, like we see the money, but we don't want those who aren't in it for the right reasons to make it, right? So it's such evidence of our systemic issues, unfortunately. And I also find myself helping people who aren't close to the finance industry understand the difference between, you know, innovation investors and traditional private equity, and they're different. And, you know, traditional private equity, even in this case of, you know, a lot of roll-ups and what Lena Khan's focused on versus private equity that's actually working with health systems to create something more competitive in their market. Like, you've seen one PE firm, kind of to Dave's point. And look, disruption is everywhere. And it's not like PE is creating the majority of the problem. But I do look at this as a bit of a perfect storm. You know, antitrust is having a moment, no doubt. At the same time that the hospital business model is turned completely upside down and may not be repairable in its current form, right? So to Dave's point, private equity is doing what it does well. It's finding opportunities and driving efficiency and scale and taking advantage of revenue enhancement opportunities, which are, by the way, probably limitless. And you know, they're not the only ones, though, I guess my point in seeing this opportunity. So my point today for me is big payers are acting like PE, but with potentially longer term effects on shaping the market landscape, you know, how care is accessed and delivered, and they want to control utilization of spend, and they want to control premium dollar. I mean, things that really will shift markets. So when I look at PE, you know, PE funds, I've seen different stats on this, so I'm hesitant to quote numbers, but there's something like $500 billion of PE funds around that number focused on healthcare. And that's, you know, all of healthcare and not just services, I don't think. But when you look at United Optum, CVS Aetna, they're making what, $300-400 billion a year. United's done, I don't know, $100 billion of transactions in the last decade. So, you know, they're aggressively moving into everything but hospitals. And while people complain about, yes, PE timelines are short, they want to hold for 3, 5, 7 years and get out and turn a profit, and healthcare systems have been around for 100 years and are going to be around for hundreds more. You know, health plans have a longer term investment thesis, but that will shape markets. So, you know, while these emerging cases that the FTC is focused on almost appear criminal, the problem is, what is the problem besides the cost of healthcare? The problem is that, you know, they'll carve off all the profitable services, and it puts the essential but unprofitable services at risk if all the profitable services are gone. Health plans also want effectively what's going to create more profit. So the health systems are left holding the bag. So I see an opportunity for health systems to really think seriously about where they have opportunity to leverage PE for driving more focus into what they do. Do they want to grow in these few areas? Do they have to because they have to compete in their geography? You know, Banner started Atlas Health Partners acting as their own PE partner with other health systems to be able to create a more PE-like relationship with their surgeons to compete with HCA and Optum who came into their area. So there's a lot of creativity here and, yeah, a lot of good and bad actors. There's no doubt.
Right. You're saying it's being painted with a pretty broad brush, but there's a lot going on under the surface that differentiates the players. That's great, Julie. Thank you. Dave, any questions for Julie?
You were walking that line between value and exploitation, I guess. So where is that line? Healthy competition, which we all want, level field competition, and antitrust activities or activities that deserve antitrust scrutiny, where the FTC and the Justice Department could really be productive? Where, if you were running those agencies, where would you direct their attention?
Well, I wish I were qualified enough to answer this question, but I'll give you my idealistic view. First of all, I'd love to see the FTC work closely with CMS and start to work on true long-term policy changes that could impact the behavior that we're seeing, but that's a pipe dream. So I guess two things. You know, first, this current FTC leadership talks a lot about market analysis, and they put a tremendous amount of effort into market analysis to make sure that they're really looking at the monopoly, monopsony, all the impacts, right? But I don't really feel like they're looking at this national reshaping by retailers, by health plans, by other innovators that's happening. So I just worry that that's not as strong, you know, and present in their work. Second, you know, it'd be nice for FTC to signal what productive characteristics of PE involvement in healthcare would look like out of all these cases that they're looking at. And that's not their role necessarily. But, you know, we've talked today about productive characteristics that could exist. So, you know, I'd love to see more of that.
So you want them to look at more than just the market share of hospital beds, right?
Right. That's right.
There's a lot going on. Thanks, Julie. I think the next stop on this train will be congressional hearings with a lot of horror stories about PE. That seems to be the natural course of things. After that, I'm not sure, but we'll be here to comment on it, and that's for sure. Now let's talk about other big news that happened this past week. Julie, what else happened that we should care about?
Well, you know, I'm not a spring chicken anymore. And in my social feed this week, I was delivered two articles that are highly relevant to healthcare and also like hilarious to me that this is how I'm being targeted. But first, there is a certain species.
Welcome to Medicare.
Yeah,
totally. There's a certain species of whale whose scientists have discovered experience menopause just like humans and chimpanzees. And there was a whole article about why the whales go through menopause. I was like, oh my God. So the second menopause article that I was targeted with is actually pretty interesting. You know, they did a study in Finland and I guess in Northern Europe, and early menopause can cause women to retire earlier. And it's mostly they're saying because once women go through menopause, they're more likely to perceive their job skills poorly than other women, making them more likely to retire on disability or what have you. So this is concerning. We should keep an eye on that.
And I'm not even going to comment on that. I'm just going to go right over to Dave.
Do whales have hot flashes? That's what I want to know.
They do underwater. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. I was shocked. I read the whole article. I was so intrigued.
Oh, man. Okay.
I'm a sucker.
All right, Dave. Anything you have that could top that? I'm not sure.
No, I definitely can't top that, but I will highlight that the FDA last week announced that Wegovy, the GLP-1 drug, that doctors can prescribe it for heart problems. And I think this raises one of these kind of really interesting questions about the structure of the healthcare system. If these GLP-1 drugs are really miracle drugs, right, that reduce obesity and all of the related things that obesity causes, heart conditions, various cancers, diabetes, and so on, then shouldn't we be broadly figuring out how to get these drugs to everybody who needs them in the country? And yet, the short-term price tag of doing that's pretty expensive, so there's all kinds of pushback to it. But, you know, since we here in the Roundup are always looking for fault lines, this strikes me as a really interesting story to follow, because I'm pretty sure the long-term benefits of these GLP-1 drugs are going to be enormous, and we're going to have to figure out how to pay for it. And I do think the market will help out here in the long run, in the sense that more manufacturers will come in and the prices will come down. But at this moment, this trade-off between long-term and short-term is front and center in healthcare. And it's the type of thing we as a society need to figure out.
Here, here.
You know, my old primary care physician thought we should put statins in the water supply, like fluoride for teeth. And I said, you know, that's a little much, but
wow,
kind of makes the point, right?
Yeah.
Same with what we're seeing with vaccines and the measles outbreak in Chicago right now.
Oh, my gosh. That was going to be my other one.
Yeah. Yeah. We know it's good for us, but we just can't seem to pull the trigger. Thanks, Dave. And thanks, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed on today's show, please visit our website, foresighthealth.com. And don't forget to tell a friend about the Foresight Health Roundup podcast. Subscribe now and don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.